Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. In this episode, Professor Jeremy Black talks to Graeme Stewart about Germany's home front during the Second World War and what ordinary Germans knew about Jewish persecution and the Holocaust.
If we're looking at Germany during World War II, and we're not concerned here primarily with its military history, we have discussed World War II in programmes in other series, but if we're looking at what you might call the home front, first, obviously, war is scarcely not part of the system. War is there very much in terms of economic mobilisation, in terms of the demographic change, the movement of so many German men into the armed forces, the movement of so many foreign labourers into Germany, in terms of the pummeling of Germany by Allied bombing, and lastly, and most monstrously, in terms of the Holocaust, which was partly enacted beyond Germany's borders, but much of which was enacted within them, not least in the sense of the forcible expulsion of German Jews to extermination camps elsewhere, and also in the presence within Germany of Jewish slave labour, which was brutalized and in many cases murdered very rapidly. Now, there are several different ways of approaching this. There is no single way. Any prioritization will appear to be subject to discussion. That's fine. Let me start off with the mobilization and issue of resources. The German public, and this is where we're starting off with, was one that initially had a degree of success in the sense that the actual assaults on the German home space in 1939, 1940, even into 1941 were limited. It was British bombing in this period. The capacity of the British planes was limited. The loss by German conquest of France meant that British air bases were further away, and of course the Germans had also conquered the Low Countries and Norway, which increased the amount of, and Denmark, of air cover they could, the Luftwaffe could provide. And on top of that, although there were Wehrmacht losses in combat in 1939 and 1940, they were extremely modest compared to what was to come later. On top of that, the degree to which the German economy, war economy, was mobilized was certainly less than was to be the case later in the war. Although, of course, already goods, for example, that might have been imported from overseas were affected by the British blockade and by the end of German transoceanic trade. But I think it's fair to say that the German standard of living was held up, not least by the looting of, in part through the manipulation of exchange rates, of areas that Germany had conquered, notably France, but also, of course, by the provision of raw materials from the Soviet Union, which helped to keep the German war economy and the German public in a degree of clover. That situation was to change the so-called combined bomber offensive, Anglo-American bombing, which became much more potent from 1942 onwards. May 1942, the British launched over 1,000 bombers at Cologne. And this, although that only killed 460 people, it did achieve its purpose of showing that there could be viable bombing attacks. And in the Casablanca conference in January 43, the Americans and the British agreed on what they termed the combined bomber offensive, with the Americans attacking by daylight and the British by night. And this had an impact. It had a major impact on the economy, dislocated it. Obviously, there were some areas in which production continued to increase, but it would have increased much more but for bombing. And on top of that, there were, you know, considerable civilian casualties. Hamburg in July 43, about 34,000 to 40,000 people killed, and the first firestorm had occurred in May at Würbürtel, a much smaller town, and over 3,500 had been killed. So there was, in other words, a pummeling of the German public, but Hitler himself was reluctant to mobilize to the extent that was to be seen in Britain and the Soviet Union. There was a reluctance to conscript married women for the industrial workforce. But nevertheless, by 44, 57% of German women, 9/10 of them single, were working. There were half a million volunteer women auxiliaries with the Wehrmacht. Many women were employed in agriculture. The Germans by 44 are very much moving to a total war capacity, helped in part by the reliance on forced labor. So in 1944, forced labor is 22.5%. of the workforce, many of them really brutally treated. Ironically, of course, if you think about all Hitler's rhetoric, reliance on foreigners meant that Germany was more ethnically mixed than hitherto, although labourers' relations with Germans, particularly sexual relations, were firmly policed. The men, meanwhile, were pushed into the armed forces. The army in the total got 17.3 million men out of Germany, and the number of divisions rose from 104 in 1940 to 238 by 1945, although their size varied. And the divisional size is about 17,000 in 39. By the end of 44, it's about 10,000. If you're looking at the direction of economic planning, I think it's fair to say that Goering had proved incompetent, not really a surprise, in his direction of planning. There were serious inefficiencies in munitions production, but there was considerable improvement from 42 when Speer increased central control. You don't have to believe all of Speer's another one, like Goebbels, like Rosenberg, like Ribbentrop, who exaggerated their own importance and what they did. And in Speer's case, sanitized himself. But he certainly did improve that side. Nevertheless, resources still proved a major problem for Germany, notably in shortages of steel, so that in my view, the German naval plans for large-scale, you know, Plan Z and everything were always non-viable, and in oil and in non-ferrous metals. And I think it's also fair to say that the German state's vicious ideology, it was at once murderous, bombastic, and rhetorical, had serious managerial flaws, as well as multiple inefficiencies. As a totalitarian regime, the Nazi state lacked the efficiencies of market discipline. But additionally, as we discussed 2 weeks ago, there was the duplication of competing agencies, which led to serious rivalries and resulted in acute confusion in policy implementation. And that situation was not helped by the laziness of Hitler. Now, if we're looking at other aspects of the war, we've already discussed the degree to which the Nazi regime is able to draw on differing groups within German society, in part by, in a sense, meaning different things to different groups. And I think it's worth saying that there was the Nazi ideas and practices, for some people were frightening, but for many people were emotionally gripping and cohesive. And that helps to maintain support. And those who were not enthusiasts tended to become compromised or compromising bystanders. I mean, you know, let's be clear about this. In the presence of the Gestapo, compromise is an understandable factor, but it doesn't make it any more attractive morally or any more prudent. Those compromises operated within a context of widespread obedience, both by sources of traditional authority who proved very ready to operate their structures to support the Nazi use of the state, for example, many clerics, much of the business community, many workers, much of the military, and all of these meant that policy such as the treatment of Jews, sort of appealed to or was accepted by the overwhelming number of people. There was resistance, but it was patchy and it was brutally repressed, for example, the White Rose group. The war, as much as Nazism, brought major changes to the nation. It brought brutalization rather than resistance. And I think this is partly to do with, you know, there was a lack of, as it were, what you might call social or civil spaces for offering alternative viewpoints, but also Allied bombing brought home the failure and led to a sort of process of social dissolution. It's worth saying that in neither peace nor war was there any equivalent to what happened in East Germany in 1953, when there were demonstrations against the communist tyranny, which were violently suppressed, nor the demonstrations of 1989, which ultimately led to the overthrow. And, you know, you can look at that different sorts of ways. You can say every circumstance is specific, which of course is the case, and that's absolutely true. Or you can also say, well, you know, there is this contrast between what happened in 53, which occurred not just outside Berlin, but in Berlin itself. Yet from the outset, alongside the sense of destiny that helped give force to Nazi plans and widespread popular view of it as yet another manifestation of the First World War, I think it's fair to say that there was a varied response as well. There was fanatical support, but also there was a degree of disillusionment and a fall in morale. It's worth noting that the Hamburg firestorm created by the British bombing created a crisis of public confidence. But it's also worth saying that the Nazi surveillance system's brutal repression of disaffection and any sign of what was called of defeatism helped to sort of police society. So again, we can very much see it in more than one way. You know, I mean, in 1945, popular resistance on behalf of the Nazis during and after the Allied conquest was a demonstration of the eventual unpopularity of the Nazis, but it didn't mean there was any lack of consent in earlier years, although it's again worth saying that there was a sceptical strand. As far as the Holocaust is concerned, the mass slaughter of Jews was carried out in the field in occupied areas, not just by the SS, but also by army units. And it was there was a more widespread complicity in the Holocaust than Germans were to find it comfortable to remember after 1945. The conquests of the early stages of the war fueled a kind of racial arrogance, a sense of entitlement to rule and direct that was very present in Nazi ideology. Letters from Wehrmacht servicemen in 41 and subsequently suggest that anti-Semitic propaganda had been widely internalized and become a dominant consensus. And it's not until 43 that it was felt necessary to introduce the National Socialist leadership officers in order to stiffen morale. Furthermore, the German prisoners of war, both ordinary servicemen and even more officers, their conversations were bugged and recorded by the British and to a degree by the Americans as well. And they revealed a widespread lack of any remorse or sense of responsibility for the brutalization of conquered people and for the slaughter of Jews. The mass deportation of Jews to extermination camps in Poland led to Germany being declared Judenfrei, Jew-free, in June 43. In practice, possibly 10 to 12,000 German Jews went into hiding, of whom about 3 to 5,000 survived the war. They were known as U-boats, i.e. submarines, submerged in ordinary life, and faced hazardous conditions, as did those Germans who provided shelter. I mean, it's worth saying some Germans provided shelter, others denounced the hidden, it's an aspect of the war that that is an instructive one. It's not only, of course, the Jews who suffered in the Nazi persecutions. Large numbers of Roma, used to be called gypsies, were killed in a separate genocide. Hitler also authorized the slaughter of mentally ill and disabled Germans unable to work. About 212,000 were killed. They were referred to by Hitler as useless eaters. Many of them were gassed or killed by lethal injection. And as with the treatment of Jews, there was no shortage of willing killers. Other groups as well, those who were referred to as misfits. Many of them were petty thieves, work shy, tramps, alcoholics, or rather those categorized as such, and indeed anybody you didn't like could be categorized as one or other, were allocated to the SS for treatment from 42, deliberately worked to death, and this reflected a desire to do what was known as purification of German society. Homosexuals, Jehovah's Witnesses, were sent to concentration camps. And Hermann Göring in October 42 declared this war is not the Second World War, this war is the Great Racial War. That idea of war against Jews remained crucial to Hitler's motivation until the very end. He thought it was a reason that it was important to go on fighting, and he sought what he regarded as a moral victory for his concept of the German people. Now, as you will know, public knowledge of the Holocaust has long been a matter of discussion, as has complicity. It's certainly true Hitler didn't announce the final solution publicly, but at the same time, Germans did know that the Jews were disappearing, and I think it's bizarre to argue that there wasn't an enormous degree of both knowledge and complicity. And it's very instructive that the fact that so many Germans thought that the Anglo-American air offensive was carried out in retribution for anti-Semitic measures indicates they knew that what was being done to Jews. It's interesting to go on to think about the last stages of the war from this point of view. There was a degree of breakdown, but on the other hand, I mean, it's interesting that Hitler continues to fight on. Totally rejects any idea of a stalemate peace, which he might have been able to negotiate with Stalin, who would have preferred him to go on fighting the Western allies. The notion for Hitler of a sort of heroic self-just destruction became a sort of decisive part of the regime's ideology and therefore its strategy. And on top of that, the Nazis are able to raise fresh manpower in the Volksstrom, the Nazi-run compulsory local defense militia, for every man aged between 16 and 60, which was established in July 44. And this was put under the control of Himmler and under Martin Bormann, the party secretary, as rather than being under the jurisdiction of the army. And there was a sort of political function in making the war a matter of morale. You know, even as the regime collapsed, there were no local revolutionary movements against it. Instead, the population at best remained politically passive, whilst many continued to show fanaticism until the very end. It's interesting, I've already referred to the attitudes among German POWs. Peter Downwood, a British officer, noted the large number of very young officers, very young soldiers, quote, dedicated to the aims of Adolf Hitler's Third Reich. They would not accept that Hitler was already dead. After the war, and indeed well into the 1980s, many Germans regretted that they'd lost the war. American assessments of German prisoners also noted Nazi loyalties, including among both Catholic and working class soldiers. So the war itself Third Reich suffered military deaths. Now that includes those of Austria, about 5.3 million, which includes 31% of the army, with 16.8% of those born between 1900 and 1928 dying in the conflict, and over 40% of those born in 1919-1920. About 20% of German housing was totally destroyed, about 20% damaged. The economy was bomb wrecked. I think it's fair to say that Hitler's Third Reich ended in a total wasteland. And it was a wasteland that he and the German people had visited on each other.
Well, Professor Black, as ever, so much to discuss. I want to start really with life on the home front in terms of the economy. I mean, there's the period when Hermann Göring is in charge, and then from 42, Albert Speer. You indicated that there was more centralized planning after Speer took over. Is it true to say that the German economy was scarcely on a war footing until at least Operation Barbarossa against the Soviet Union in 1941?
Well, I wouldn't go quite as far as that, but I would say it wasn't on an adequate war footing. I mean, it starts off with an interesting state of economic equations. I mean, in some respects, world chemical production in 1938, it has 22% of the world's chemical production, which is second only to America. But its electricity production was well below that of America, Britain, France, and Japan. It lacked adequate fuel, and its agriculture was much less efficient than that of America and Britain. There were multiple inefficiencies, of course, in the Soviet Union, but it's worth pointing out that the Soviet Union was able, through brutality, and to get more out of its resources, and crucially, of course, also had a lot of oil and coal and steel. In 1938, Germany has a per capita GDP of $5,126, and that's higher than that of France, but it compares to just over $1,000 more per capita for America, and $860 more per capita for Britain. And Britain, of course, can also, like France, call on a global trading system. So yes, I would say that Germany is in a weaker position.
How is it that nevertheless, it managed to keep up living standards so well during that period without having the resources that, for example, the British Empire could call upon. I mean, stretched, of course, as that was, and liable to sinking by German U-boats. But you know, there's a lack of oil. How is it that this German economy is, at one level seems to be half-cocked, nevertheless is able to support the population in a reasonable standard of living and help prosecute wars on two fronts?
Well, I think you're absolutely right to ask the question. My attitude to that would be, first of all, they make an enormous amount of loot from the areas they've conquered. So, for example, a lot of German armaments and armament production in 39 onwards comes from Skoda and other works they've acquired in Czechoslovakia in 38, 39. So I think that they are benefiting an enormous amount from that. And you know, it's worth pointing out, as I've said, I mean, their GDP is not fantastic, but it's, you know, above that of France and it's above that of anywhere in Eastern Europe. I mean, the best book on the Nazi economy is that by Adam Tooze. And I think I would say a bit more than he does, although he does talk about it, about the manipulation of exchange rates, which makes it even easier to loot France. But the Germans are looting a lot of areas they've conquered. Of course, ironically, their looting is part of their built-in inefficiency.
Mm-hmm. And also, of course, until 1941, they're getting supplies from the Soviet Union. How significant were those supplies from the Soviet Union? And was Operation Barbarossa really a case of the Germans cutting off their nose to spite their face in this respect?
Well, in that respect, yes, absolutely. But of course, it's part and parcel of a central part and parcel of Hitler's ideology. There's no two ways about that. But the resources are very important. And I think they also give, I mean, in a way, what they mean is that Germany is on an open frontier economically, the frontier stretching eastwards to encompass resources which can then be moved by railway into the Third Reich. And in a sense, it brings to a head the concern that had been expressed by Sir Halford Mackinder in his geopolitical work in 1904 about a sort of heartland, and that heartland, which was, you know, from 39 to 41, the German-Soviet alignment, being able to press on other areas of the world. Now, interestingly enough, and I mentioned this, discussed this in my book on geopolitics, history of geopolitics, this had been an anxiety you see mentioned in a number of cases by the British during the century. You see it mentioned in 1918 with the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk and Germany taking over large parts of Russia. You see it mentioned whenever there are signs of German Soviet alignment. Now, the point about Hitler offering, as it were, having a choice, one has to be careful here. As you yourself said, there have been a number of scholars who have written on the German policy and its principal objectives. I have to tell you, I think he's a very pleasant chap, I think Brendan Sims's account of Hitler being fundamentally motivated by antipathy to the United States is very flawed, very weak. Hitler's vicarious hatred was for Slavs, and he very much has, if you like, an Austrian mentality towards the Balkans and Eastern Europe. Obviously, he doesn't like what he sees as the democracy and consumerism and decadence racial intermixing of the United States and some of those elements of Britain. But I think you, for a man whose fundamental view of the world is based on hatred and expressed through hatred, you will always find with Hitler harsh comments about most other peoples. But I think he has particular venom for communists and what he saw as Jewish Bolshevism.
Turning to the life or lives of ordinary Germans during the war, during wartime, given that everything they read, everything they heard, everything they saw was Nazi propaganda, once the war started to turn against Germany during 1943, how much reality nevertheless intruded, however couched, into what they learned about what was going on?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, I wouldn't exactly say that the Third Reich went in for reality. That's an interesting idea. I mean, if you look at the popular films, as you may know, there were a lot of popular films produced under the Third Reich, and they were very instrumental to back particular ideas of the regime. There's the historical biographies of Frederick the Great in 1942, of Bismarck, and the one in 1940 during the period of alignment with the Soviet Union. We see Bismarck not being hostile to Russia, incidentally. You get anti-Semitic films such as The Eternal Jew in 1940 and Jew Seuss in 1940. I wouldn't exactly say that those are objective accounts of anything at all. There is a lot of propaganda. German newsreels are extraordinarily propagandist. Now, you might say all works in wartime are propagandist, and to a degree that is true. I think you've got several things to say about the Germans. They really do push it very, very, very far in any sense, with hatred very much their motivation, to a degree that you don't see in terms of hatred with the British or the American approach to the Germans. And of course, it's worth saying that the Nazis were building on their pre-war attacks on culture that they didn't like. So, for example, a chap called Hans Jobst in J-O-H-S-T in 1933 writes a play that's performed on Hitler's birthday about a Freikorps member who'd been executed by the French in 1923 for sabotaging a railway. And that play includes the line, "When I hear culture, I release the safety catch on my Browning." A Browning is a gun, of course. Now, this hero is commemorated in memorials referred to in Mein Kampf. Interestingly enough, he becomes president of the Reich Chamber of Literature. He becomes an SS Oberführer, and he goes on having a post-war life in which, goes on till 1978, and which is unrepentant to the end. So I think it's fair to say that indoctrination, if you wish to use that term, certainly propaganda, but a lot of it reflects, unfortunately, views that are widespread, is very much to the fore under the Nazi regime.
Mm-hmm. A huge amount, obviously, of anti-Semitic propaganda. You mentioned that the actual Holocaust itself was not announced and was not presented to the German public in newsreels. But at the same time, the notion of the German Reich being declared as Judenfree, of Judenfrei, be free of Jews. I mean, you wouldn't have to have a particularly high IQ in Germany to work out that if your country is suddenly free of the Jews, something bad has happened to them. How was this moderated by German propaganda? On the one hand, not going into the detail; on the other hand, boasting that the country had become racially pure.
Well, I mean, first of all, by the way, by going back to your first point, and I do discuss this in my book on the Holocaust, I mean, a lot of the treatment of the Jews was fairly public, not just at the end of the war when people are marched from concentration camps and, you know, you get the death marches, not just with Jewish slave labor in the cities and in factories, but also when Jews were deported to go to the extermination camps. And of course, as you are probably aware, a lot of people were, you know, informed by their relatives in the East what has been going on. So I think it is, insofar as it is, known, which I think it is known very widely. And I think that in a sense, it's presented to many as an opportunity. Jewish apartments are distributed, Jewish goods are given out. There's no secret about where these things have come from. I think the Nazis didn't really have much of a problem at providing a propaganda that makes sense of what they're doing. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen Juicers. It's a which was a popular film. I mean, more popular than the film The Eternal Jew. You get a fiendish Jewish moneylender who terrorizes a virtuous Aryan maiden only to be publicly executed at the end. Well, you can take whatever view you like on that. I think it's a vile film, but it was certainly pretty clear to the audience what was the necessary process that needed to be followed.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have to draw down the curtain on this dismal tale in this black period in European history. But for talking through Germany in the Second World War, life and experience in the German Reich itself, Professor Jeremy Black, who's A Brief History of Germany, is now published. Thank you very much indeed.
Many thanks indeed.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.